From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, how a very cool Lake Michigan is impacting our relatively cool summer.
We're not just bringing in, you know, slightly cooler air. We're bringing in much cooler air, and that mixes out and keeps things generally cool. So unless we get a southwest wind, we've had some influence, I think, from not only Lake Michigan, but the Great Lakes, too.
Plus, some insight into Wisconsin's storm chaser community, how the Milwaukee Art Museum's cafe matches food with art exhibits, and a Waukesha writer remembers years of trips to the Boundary Waters.
It was also a challenge by, you know, friends and brothers to, could we really rough it, and could we do it well, and could we do it right? And we did a little of both. We did it right and we did it wrong, but we learned along the way.
Lake Effect comes your way next after news from NPR and Milwaukee Public Radio. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for being with us today. You know, it was back in January of this year that we spoke with meteorologist Mike Westendorf of Innovative Weather at UW-Milwaukee about the breathtaking cold snap that settled in over the upper Midwest, sending temperatures in the Milwaukee area down to nearly 20 below zero. It was really cold, but at least cold weather is par for the course in a Milwaukee January. But it seems a bit more unusual to be using the term cold snap to describe a July weather pattern, but that's exactly what we were in this week. And so Mike Westendorf is back with us to explain what is going on now. Welcome back to the show.
Great to be here.
How does the cool weather pattern we have been experiencing this week compare to the Arctic cold we felt over the winter? I mean, obviously temperatures are different, but are the natures of the systems related? Is it the same thing causing it?
Boy, a little bit like apples to oranges. The atmosphere is really in a far different state. You know, we're always, if you want to look at the commonality of troughs and ridges, then that is something that would certainly be applicable in that regard. But the jet stream is quite a bit weaker this time of year. Obviously, we're much, much warmer. And it's not uncommon for us to see, you know, a few days of this cooler weather. What's different about this one is that, again, we're talking days rather than weeks. And that's been something that's been a gradual change as we got into June. Our entire winter, from mid-October, we've been watching it. Mid-October is when it changed. We went from 5 degrees above average in general per week, you know, that was where we were, to we would see about 5 days that were 5 to 10 degrees below normal, one day that was seasonal, and one day that might be a little bit above. And it just kept like that week after week after week all the way through the winter and most of the spring. Not until June did we start finally getting into more sustainable, warm, or more seasonal periods.
How is the weather affecting Lake Michigan or vice versa? How is Lake Michigan affecting our weather?
It kind of goes both ways. You know, the heat capacity of dry air or dry ground, it heats up and it cools off much, much faster. But it takes a lot longer for Lake Michigan to be able to heat up, if you will. I was kind of talking to some of the guys at the School of Freshwater Science, and they were talking a little bit about the thermoclines too, that the lake is turbulent. And so it takes a while. Once those the temperatures in the lake actually start to stratiate a little bit and become more stratified, then the surface temperatures finally start warming up. So that was something of a delay of like 5 weeks, if I remember hearing them talk about it correctly. And so what happened is that the lake just was very, very slow to warm up. We're right now, when I looked at last year this morning, the general surface temperatures are sitting in the lower and middle 60s. You know, you contrast that to, you know, a couple of years ago when we were hot and the surface temperatures were in the 70s to near 80 by early August. We won't be anything like that, you know, this year. But it does have a huge impact on us. It means that the lake breezes are more common. They are stronger. You know, if the inland areas out toward Madison heat up to around 80 degrees, you get that lake breeze that develops. And we're not just bringing in, you know, slightly cooler air. We're bringing in much cooler air, and that mixes out and keeps things generally cool. So unless we get a southwest wind, we've had some influence, I think, from not only Lake Michigan, but the Great Lakes, too.
And while it may not have been an especially warm summer overall, it does seem to have been an active summer for weather.
That it has been. You know, I was talking to Dr. Rober, who runs Innovative Weather and is one of our synopticians here and a great researcher. And we're talking a little bit about what about the impact of, for example, a cooler Great Lakes. You know, Lake Superior still had ice on it at the end of May. I have a picture of my cousin standing on pack ice along the South Shore on May 25th. Now, what possessed him to do that, I'm not sure, but the fact that there was ice still sitting on Lake Superior at the end of May, and we have a very, very cold, you know, Great Lakes, and so on nights where it's clear, these temperatures cool off a little bit further. Like I said, the lake breeze kicks in, and that actually can have, I'm kind of wondering, I'm posing this to some of the researchers, but it has seemed to appear that it left the trough anchored right through the Great Lakes area. The trough is an area of cooler temperatures in the atmosphere. You can look at it one way. And that trough then sets up the jet stream, and so it positioned the jet to be simply right over the top of us. Now, there are a lot of other factors to push that here, but I think that the energy that we've had, the fact that it's much, much warmer and more humid just to the south of us, we have generally been in that frontal area and an active area. And it just hasn't really left, and I have a suspicion that it may, at least in some small part, have to do with how cool the Great Lakes have been for so long.
And yet a fairly slow season for tornadoes. Not that they haven't appeared at all, but there have been some years where there have been many more by this time of year.
Right. A lot of what we've been dealing with has been more of the squall line-based thunderstorms. We haven't had a lot of big shear events where you get a significant area of low pressure. There's a lot of spin in the atmosphere. We've had a lot of stationary fronts that have set up, and those tend to be more conducive to these big clusters of thunderstorms and the Bow Echo squall line that brought all of the outages to southeastern Wisconsin. We've had more of those, and not quite the supercell environment that you more commonly would find the more active tornadoes coming from.
So if temperatures are forecast to rebound to the low and mid-70s at least, when are we likely to see the weather completely shift back to more seasonal norms, temperatures in the low to mid-80s, say?
At least in terms of the long-range projection, we're pushing. High pressure is going to be basically settled over the top of us through about Saturday, and then we'll get the push of some of that warmer, more humid air as you get out into Sunday, Monday, Tuesday of next week. I suppose I should mention that, too, that's been the other interesting thing about this. Not only has it been cooler, but you're also tapping into that northeast wind, and so you bring in some lower dew points and drier. Have you noticed how many nights it's been great to just open the windows and sleep?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know, and that has to do with that very, very dry air. We've not had a ton of humidity, and certainly when it's come, it's almost always come with heavy shower and thunderstorm activity. And so as we look out into the extended, we get some of that trying to push back as you get into early parts of next week.
Mike Westendorf, thank you so much.
You bet.
Meteorologist Mike Westendorf is Director of Operations for Innovative Weather at UW-Milwaukee. As we heard, there has been some severe weather this summer, but it has been a pretty quiet season for tornadoes. And while it's hard to call that a disappointment, it certainly meant that a couple of groups have been less busy this year. Tim McCormick writes about Wisconsin's storm spotting and storm chasing communities in the current issue of Milwaukee Magazine, and he's with us to share what he's learned in his reporting. Hi, Tim. Welcome back to Lake Effect.
Thank you so much for having me.
What turned you on to the work of storm chasers here in Wisconsin?
I was actually doing research, I think it was back in February or so, and the movie Twister has kind of caught my attention. It's one that I can't turn away from anytime it comes up on cable. But I saw this group that does training for storm spotters throughout southeastern Wisconsin. And we kind of got in touch with one of the organizers there and found out what they do exactly, and then got in touch with a couple of storm chasers. There's a slight difference there.
Yeah, you mentioned storm spotters, and there's a network called
yes.
the Skywarn Network,
yes.
correct?
Yeah, here we have the Milwaukee Area Skywarn Association, and they kind of work in, I don't know about in tandem, but hand in hand with the National Weather Service. When severe weather strikes, they'll be out in the field and kind of reporting back to the National Weather Service, letting them know what they've seen. And that really helps the National Weather Service kind of react to what kind of warnings and watches they'll have to be issuing, and the progress of the storm, though obviously radar is a great tool for them, but this gives them kind of eyes on the ground.
Well, and so you say the activity that they do is distinct from what somebody who's technically a storm chaser does.
Yeah.
And so talk about that difference. What is it that storm chasers are doing that the Skywarn members are not doing?
I think the storm chasers, for the most part, they're interested in getting into the thick of it and kind of videotaping the footage or maybe taking some stellar photographs and that sort of thing. And they also may go beyond the state's borders to chase after these awesome weather events. So the difference, the spotters are probably, you know, just sticking to their neck of the woods, reporting back to the National Weather Service. And then the storm chasers will outfit their cars with special GPS and other software and then go and chase tornadoes and whatever else might come our way.
Right. You actually talked with one of these storm chasers who I think has a Honda CR-V that he has completely outfitted for storm chasing.
Refers to it as the Geekmobile. But yeah, he'll have his special equipment so that he can track a storm's progress and also find out what his best and quickest exit is as well.
Well, and what the two groups, the storm chasers and the storm spotters or the Skywarn spotters, seem to have in common is they both actually are serving some public service with
Absolutely.
What they're doing.
Absolutely. Kenny Adams, one of the chasers that we profiled here in the magazine, he's done work with the University of Oklahoma on some of their research and that sort of thing. And then, like we said previously, the storm spotters, they're just making sure that you get the word out. You don't want to be here if this severe weather is hitting.
You've also spoken with somebody whose job it is, among her jobs, taking really remarkable photographs, including the one that graces this article.
Yes. Jennifer Brinley is an excellent local photographer here, but last year alone, she logged more than 25,000 miles throughout the Midwest chasing after storms. As we were putting this article together, it was kind of tough to get in touch with her because she was out in Nebraska chasing some storms. But she refers to it as the most expensive hobby on earth because she has to log all those miles. She's got to worry about her own lodging and that sort of thing. And she really doesn't recoup any of those costs. She might sell a reproduction of the photo here and there, but otherwise it's just a hobby that she likes to pursue.
And certainly the picture that accompanies this article is from Milwaukee.
Right,
and
right.
Really dramatic as much as anything else.
Yeah, and it's been kind of, as we all know, Mother Nature really has no rhyme or reason. Couple of years back, we had a record day of tornadoes hit. I think it was 27 twisters touched down in one day.
And this year has been much slower.
This year much slower. I think we had the latest first reported tornado in Wisconsin that we've ever recorded. So, they get out. They do see some things in their backyard, but more often than not, they're chasing down into Nebraska, off into Oklahoma, throughout Tornado Alley.
And do I understand there are videos that accompany this article that you can watch online?
There are. If you go to MilwaukeeMag.com, we'll be able to point you to some spectacular footage that Kenny Adams was gracious enough to share with us.
You are couching your language. It is tough to say he was fortunate enough to get this, but he was fortunate enough to get this and not get killed by these storms.
Yeah, yeah. The chasers that we spoke with emphasized that safety is obviously their number one concern. They want to stay alive, just like the rest of us. So before they go out, they are studying weather patterns. They're studying the maps, trying to figure out their best route and their best escape. So they want to stay safe. It's not these gung-ho people that are just in there for the thrill.
Did you get the sense that the people are interested not necessarily in storm chasing, but storm spotting? Are there opportunities to be trained to be a Skywarn spotter?
Absolutely. And that the Milwaukee Area Skywarn Association, like I said, every spring they'll have, you can take a look at their website, they'll start posting when they have these classes throughout southeastern Wisconsin. And there too, their emphasis is on safety, making sure that nobody gets hurt doing this.
As you say, the movie Twister always captures your attention when it's on TV. Is this an activity that you have either done or are interested in pursuing yourself?
As the father of two boys, my interest has definitely waned, but as the husband of a beautiful bride from Kansas City, she lived right in the Tornado Alley, and so she's always excited when those weather events hit, so she'll take us out and try to spot, but obviously still stay safe.
Tim McCormick, thanks.
I appreciate the time.
Tim McCormick is managing editor at Milwaukee Magazine. His article on Wisconsin's storm spotters and storm chasers is in the July issue. We'll take a break now and then learn how the Milwaukee Art Museum's cafe tries to make its food match the art upstairs. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. Yesterday on the show, we heard about a novel based on the life of Gabriela Munter, the German painter who had a long-term affair with Russian painter Wassily Kandinsky in the early 20th century. A retrospective of Kandinsky's career is currently on exhibit at the Milwaukee Art Museum, and today we take a detour to the Art Museum's kitchen, where the culinary team has created a menu based on the Kandinsky exhibit upstairs. It's not a new idea. The team prepares a menu for every special exhibit at the museum. Lake Effect's Bonnie North visited with chef de cuisine Micah Kaufman and sous chef Jamie Nelson in the kitchen, and Kaufman explained how each menu is planned.
Everything begins with a meeting with the curator. For this specific exhibition, the head curator is Brady Roberts. He's our chief curator at the Art Museum, and we get a concept for him on what pieces are going to be prominent, what colors he would like to use, and if there are any specific foods that the curator feels would perfectly represent the food. They give us the direction to go start researching, and then Jamie and I hit the books, and we start reading.
That was going to be my question. So you actually have to do some art history research.
Oh, yes. Try and find whatever we can on the pieces that are featured in the exhibition and little background information on the artist and his or her history.
Do you do things as simple as try to find or recreate food that the artist might have liked, or are you really focusing on the art?
Well, every artist is different, and every exhibition is a little different. Some of them are exhibitions where we can make the food look just like the art. Sometimes that's not really what the art is. So we try to achieve a balance between representing what the art looks like on the plate and also representing some information about the artists themselves. Oftentimes we'll go through their life history and have dishes that represent different periods in their life. Or we'll have dishes that we think the artist might enjoy today.
How do you then take all of that, you know, the history and everything that you're learning, and then turn it into food that is just interesting for people now, whether they know anything about the artist or not?
We have kind of a broad clientele here at the Art Museum, so we try to find ways to sneak in little elements that are from the artist or the art itself, but make it approachable to everyone.
You know, how have you done that? Taken that, you know, kind of grand idea and turned it to something on the plate that people actually want to eat?
For this Kandinsky menu, we have an awesome dish called shashlik. Shashlik are just Russian-style kebabs. Every culture has a tradition of skewering and grilling meat. In Russia, they call it shashlik. Now, Wassily Kandinsky began his journey in Moscow, in Russia, moved to Berlin, and then moved to Paris. This dish, we tried to represent each of those movements. So it's got the Russian shashlik with a summer borscht underneath. It's got German herb spätzle, and then a French-style lemon confit right on top. But the dish itself tells a story about his journey.
So is that something that you try to do, is you try to tell a story with the food as well?
Our main goal is to enhance the exhibition experience. The big show is going on upstairs. We want to be here to feed people once they get done and help educate them a little bit more and show them that this can be fun. Art is for everybody. So is food. One of the missions of the Milwaukee Art Museum is to make great works of art accessible to the people of Milwaukee. One of our goals as chefs is to make great food accessible to the people of Milwaukee. So another element we have on this new menu is an American caviar that we are selling for very, very affordable prices. As an art museum and as a nonprofit, we get a special ability to do to look out for the guest and to help give them a wow experience factor. We want people walking out of this cafe tasting flavors that they've never tasted before, combinations they've never had before, and plating styles that they've never seen before.
Now, is there ever a time when you try to make it look like something on the plate other than food?
Actually, an example of some of our food looking like the art upstairs is our Kandinsky cookie. We actually partnered with Stone Creek Coffee and Bakery for this menu, and they created cookies to look like Kandinsky's concentric circle painting.
Tell me some of your favorite things. It doesn't have to be from this menu, but of stuff that you felt, boy, we really hit it. We made it work with what was going on, and just in terms of flavors and everything, it all came together.
I have a couple of examples that would jump out at me. I'm really looking forward to this new Kandinsky menu, though, because so many pieces were they're ideas that we've been working on for over a year, and so to finally see these things on the plate has been a really special experience for both Jamie and myself. During the intermission, in between exhibitions, we spend that time demoing and tweaking our dishes to make sure they're exactly how we want them. This specific exhibition, a lot of the food came up exactly the way that we had envisioned it, which is incredibly satisfying as a creative exercise. There are some dishes in the past that we really liked and that really sang and really hit, but we can't think about the past. We got to think about today, and we got to think about the future. So while it's finally the birth of Kandinsky time, we're working on our next exhibition already. We're already hitting the books, and we're already starting to think about what our menu is going to look like in September for the Heaven and Earth exhibition.
Who's testing it? Or is it just you guys? Do you bring it out to the staff? How does that work?
Well, during this intermission time in between the exhibitions, we print a daily menu. We'll introduce the dish that's going to be on the next menu on that daily menu. And we ask our guests directly, how do they like it? How do they feel about it? We also work with, in the museum, we also do a lot of takeout for people downtown. People can come and get their food to go. And we get feedback from them, people who work at the museum, who work at the War Memorial, and who work around us. We're constantly looking for feedback and ways to improve our dishes. That being said, we have some extraordinarily dedicated people working in our front of the house who are able to take the ideas that Jamie and I talk about on a daily basis and translate that to the guest.
One of the things about Kandinsky, of course, is color. I mean, he was such a colorist, and he was so interested in color. How has that translated into the dishes here? Do you have a specific thing that reflects that?
I think we tried to use that a little bit on every dish we put out for this menu. We recognize that was something I learned. I didn't have much experience with Kandinsky before we started researching this menu, and soon found out it was all about the color. So every dish we tried to come up with was like, it's got to be colorful and use everything and anything we could to reflect that.
And you also have, like you were saying before, Micah, you've got Russia, you've got Germany, and you've got Paris. So not only do you have a lifetime of his work to go through, but you've got three very distinct cuisines that you can use here. Other than the shashlik, how have you incorporated these other cuisines?
Well, one of the really fun parts about our job is we can take these elements, these European-style elements, or we can take the theories or the concept that the artist had, but we got to translate it using Wisconsin food. In speaking with the chief curator, when we first had our first conversations about this, Brady mentioned a dish that he had when he was visiting the work when they were considering bringing it here called Xander. It's a whitefish, kind of like perch or pike perch or things like that. And our initial thought was like, well, great, let's do Xander. But we're in Wisconsin in the summertime. There's no way I'm shipping fish across the ocean. So we have some really fantastic lake perch that's similar to the texture and style of the Xander, but we got to kind of make it our own. Another example of that would be our Bauhaus Bratburger. Kandinsky spent a good amount of time living in Berlin and working at the Bauhaus. He would have had a bratwurst somewhere in there.
More than once.
Yeah. And that's on a pretzel bun with sauerkraut and stone mustard aioli. It doesn't get much more German than that. But here we are in Wisconsin. We have all of that. So we've got Johnsonville brats going out right now. Pretzel buns from Miller Bakery. One of the important things about our job is to source as locally as we possibly can. So we're constantly working with purveyors and working with other restaurants on ideas on where to get the best food, where to get the freshest food, and where to get the most locally grown food. So the fun part is taking these European concepts and translating it through Wisconsin food. One of the other fun things is that as a Milwaukee Art Museum, we draw visitors from all over the world, and we want to be able to use that chance to demonstrate how great Milwaukee food is and how great Wisconsin food is.
Now, on an average lunch, I know there's probably no such thing, but in terms of, sort of a normal day, how many lunches are you serving?
I'd say a good day, we'll do about 120, 130 covers for lunch, which for a lunch operation is fantastic. We'll always take more. We'd love to have more. But as a lunch place, and especially being downtown, we're a great place for people to come to during their lunch hour. We have folks from the U.S. Bank Building and Northwestern Mutual coming down here for lunch. They got to be in and out in an hour. So at about 11:30 to about 1 o'clock, we're pushing hard. And this place is packed, and we get out as much food as we possibly can. But we're open until 4.
When do you start?
About 8:30 every morning.
Okay, so it's basically, you're almost doing an 8 to 5.
Try an 8 to 9.
8 to 9?
Yeah. We have so many other events that we hold here as well. Not only do we have the cafe and the coffee shop, but we have multiple rooms that are open for people to host their parties in. We have spaces for them to have baby showers, weddings, engagement parties. In the last week, we've done 3 or 4 weddings, a couple baby showers, and an engagement party. So there's always, always more to do.
In addition to that 130 plates you do for lunch.
Exactly.
Right. So how many staff do you have on a normal day?
On a normal day, we staff about 10 to 11 cooks. On busy days, that number can get up to 15 or 17. We have an extraordinarily dedicated culinary staff here. Jamie and I have both reached out to the best cooks that we've ever worked with, and we've assembled a very powerful team. We've got a lot of cooks here who have executive chef and sous chef experience. All combined, we have well over a century worth of culinary experience.
That's fabulous. That's great. Well, I'm seeing color going on a plate.
Absolutely. So this is our beet paint, and it's not real paint. Like, everybody calm down. It's not real paint. It's borscht, except we use a pastry brush. One of the things we really like doing here is using our culinary tools as if they were artistic tools. So we take a pastry brush, just like you would use to put an egg wash on a pie or something like that, and we use that to spread the beet paint onto the plate. And it really gives it an interesting look to it and a dynamic that really pops in the dining room. So if you can imagine the blue of the lake, the white of the cafe and of the Milwaukee Art Museum, and then that deep red right on your plate, it's really something to look at.
And well, it is beautiful, and also, as you were saying, you can see the shapes and what Kandinsky would use, his curves and the geometric.
Exactly.
And color.
The contrast between straight lines and curves is something that was really prevalent in a lot of his pieces. He saw it as sort of a musicality, and we try to represent that on the plate as best we can.
I have to ask, do you have a favorite dish from this menu for yourself?
Personally, I like the shashlik. I'm a meat and potatoes kind of girl. I'll take, my pork and spetzel any day.
Any day, yeah. And how about you, Micah? Do you have a favorite dish from this menu that you just would like to eat?
This salmon is really fantastic. We do our best here to make sure that we're sourcing everything as responsibly as we possibly can. So this is a really fantastic salmon out of a farm in Scotland called Wester Ross. We bring in the fish whole. We break it down ourselves, which is something that we really enjoy. And this is a dish that I've been playing with for a while, so I'm really excited to finally get it on a menu. For cheese, we're featuring Saxon Creamery out of Cleveland, Wisconsin. So we've got their monastery style and their pastures, their white cheddar style. We like to move with each menu. We like to move to a different dairy farm. A lot of restaurants have different cheeses from different dairy farms in Wisconsin. We find, and especially having this, 1 hour limit to speak to our guests, some of whom, this is going to be their only experience in Wisconsin. We want to give them one solid example. So at the end of this summer, we'll move on to another dairy farm. But right now, we're featuring some really awesome cheese from Saxon Creamery in Cleveland, Wisconsin.
At first, to me personally, it seemed like an intimidating task trying to come up with a Russian-inspired menu for the middle of summer in Wisconsin. I didn't think people would go for the traditional heavy, heavy meat and potatoes and beets and pickled everything that's common in Russian cuisine. But one thing we found was this salad Olivier was prevalent on almost every Russian restaurant menu that Micah and I researched. So we thought we'd definitely have to feature that on the menu. That's something Kandinsky would probably eat if he went out to a restaurant
today. He probably
would
have recognized it.
Yes.
Yeah. And so what's in it?
So this has fingerling potatoes, baby carrots, peas, hard-boiled eggs from Yuppie Hill Farms, and fresh dill, cornichon, a little bit of pickles in there. There's pickles in everything in Russia. And we make our own grapeseed mayo. So this is a mayonnaise that's made with grapeseed oil instead of corn oil. We feel that it gives it a lot lighter flavor, and it's also much healthier. Okay. This salad is very, very healthy, and it's dressed absolutely minimally. We separate the egg yolks from the whites and use the egg yolks as a garnish right on top.
It looks delicious and light and fresh.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
absolutely. And it's filling. I mean, there's three or four potatoes in there.
Right.
You know, small potatoes. There's three or four small carrots in there.
Yep.
A couple eggs. Once you get to the end of it, you're full.
And then the salmon has been plated, which is gorgeous. So in addition to the cucumber cream and the beet, we have some sort of frisée or something?
Yes, it's a frisée and fennel salad with cashews. So we just use the fennel fronds instead of the fennel that's in there. So we got some great crispiness from the fennel. We've got some crunchiness from the bagel chip that's right on top. And we just take a bagel and slice it as thin as possible, sprinkle some olive oil, salt, and pepper on it, and bake it until it's nice and crunchy. Finally, the salmon is spiced with an ingredient called sashimi togarashi. It's a Japanese seven spice. And that's going to bring some heat to it and a little bit of excitement to complement the cucumber cream right underneath.
Well, it all looks fantastic. And I can't thank you both enough for taking time out of the lunch rush to talk to me today about the new menu here at the Art Museum. But such a pleasure to hear a little bit about what happens behind the scenes.
Thank you so much. It's our pleasure, and please come back anytime.
Yes, thank you very much.
Micah Kaufman is chef de cuisine, and Jamie Nelson is sous chef at the Milwaukee Art Museum's Cafe Calatrava. They spoke with Bonnie North. The cafe's Kandinsky menu is available through September 1st. One last break, and then the author of a recent memoir on a family's trips to the Boundary Waters Canoe Area in Minnesota. It's Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Teich. Summer is a time for things like hiking, swimming, canoeing, family vacations, and sometimes all of the above wrapped up into one. For Waukesha writer Jim Landwehr, the best place to pursue all of these activities is the Boundary Waters Canoe Area in far northern Minnesota. Landwehr's been going to the Boundary Waters for decades, and for a while, it was a family tradition that he and his brothers would take canoe trips there together. He details the lessons he learned on these trips, from the importance of a clean shirt to the importance of family, in a new memoir called Dirty Shirt, a Boundary Waters memoir. Landwehr tells Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce about what first drew him to the Boundary Waters.
It was this super remote allure of the area. It was, and the boat motors were allowed, but there weren't very many there. It was just a rustic terrain, just an adventure, I guess. And the weather we had up there was just kind of added to the whole mystique of it. And it just it made me want to go back further north and into rougher conditions just to see if I could do it.
One of the interesting things about this book is you never quite describe yourself as an expert outdoorsman, yet you take these really big outdoors challenges on going into this relative wilderness.
Yeah, it was, again, it really began with my dad going up there in the past and kind of, you know, wanting to walk in his footsteps in some respects. And it was also a challenge by, you know, friends and brothers to, could we really rough it, and could we do it well, and could we do it right? And we did a little of both. We did it right and we did it wrong, but we learned along the way too. So
you mentioned your brothers, and a big portion of the book is dedicated to the trips that you made with them. But there's another reason too why you wrote this book.
Yeah, there was. It was about brotherhood and about bonding and that kind of things with other family members. But it was really written, you know, for an audience of families. Originally, it was supposed to be just my family stories written down for posterity, and it kind of took on a life of its own, to where my writing instructor said, would you like to take this to the wider world? And I said, well, do you think it would sell? And she said, sure. And she said, there's family elements in there, there's adventure in there, there's bonding. She said it would appeal to not just outdoors lovers, but to family people who love family and love relationships. So
Well, I want to go back to some of your early camping and canoeing adventures in the Boundary Waters canoe area. Some of these early trips were less fortunate than the later ones. Mm-hmm. Tell us about some of the important nature lessons you learned during some of these early trips.
I guess the first one we learned was just a healthy respect for the water, knowing that when we went out the first time, it was on a river system, and thinking that, you know, this is adventure and it's running the rapids as part of that adventure. Well, if you don't run the rapids right, you will pay a price for the rest of the trip. And so that was our first exposure, was just doing it wrong can make your life miserable. So we learned from that, and then we went ahead and continued to learn and grow as we went. But the other item that we learned was just that things that matter back home don't matter up in the woods. What matters is keeping dry, keeping warm, helping each other out. Things that you take for granted at home, but along with that, you don't have the stresses of some of the things you have in city urban life as well. So as we went, we learned a little bit from each of those adventures, and we got better at it as we went along.
You hadn't finished the first trip.
Right, right. I had to turn back with a friend, and this guy went ahead with another friend, and they finished it, and we went back, and he said, if you're not all right with that, let's go back and do it again. It was really kind of a relief to myself to be able to actually finish what we had started a year before.
Why was it so important to you to finish that?
Well, for me especially, being that I thought I was the most outdoorsy of them all. And so when I didn't make it the first trip, I was like, well, I can do better than this. And I was out to prove it to myself, prove it to them, and to prove it to my family as well in some respects. And to, even though my dad wasn't around, just to be able to say, yeah, I did do it. And, you know, I think he would have been proud of that, I guess.
Tell us about then the genesis of the brothers' trips.
Those came out of a discussion we had. I think we were at a bar somewhere and somebody said, well, what do you think about going up to the Boundary Waters together and fishing and stuff? And we all kind of agreed that that might be kind of fun because we had kind of been disconnected through the high school years, and this was a good way to regroup in our college years and just kind of hang out for a week. And so we all love to fish. We all love the outdoors. Not having grown up with a dad, we kind of thought, well, this would be a good chance to maybe learn a little bit about what he saw in the area. And so it just kind of took on a life of its own, on top of being able to reconnect once a year to go a little bit deeper below the surface than, hey, how's the weather, Merry Christmas, you know, kind of the holiday greetings, and find out what's really going on in our lives. So it was a connection point, too, for us.
What did you learn about your family?
I learned that as much as we have our own unique characteristics and differences, that really the only ones we have is each other when it comes right down to it. Growing up in a single-parent family, that was, you know, kind of an undercurrent the whole time. But this kind of made us realize that even though we have our quibbles and our gripes and some of our past history, that really when you get right down to it, we're going to be there for each other. And it proved itself later in life, obviously, with some of the later book stuff. So it was really a cementing of something that we knew was there anyways, but it really helped, I think, in the brothers anyways, bring us together like nothing else could have.
Do you think you found out there in the Boundary Waters what had appealed to your father?
Absolutely. I think we did, because it takes you to a spot that is so remote that all you have is what you hear, see, and taste. And you have a lot of time to think about life back home. You have a lot of time to think about where you've been, where you're going. My father, from what I understand, was a bit of a lost soul. So I think this was his way of, you know, finding his way as well. So we all kind of came away every year going, yeah, this was good, and this is what Dad would have done. This is what Dad, he would be here if he could. And it was just kind of an agreement that there was nothing negative coming out of these trips at all. It was all good.
What were some of the funnier memories you have from some of these trips that maybe didn't go perfectly?
Well, there's several, and everything from the homemade roof rack we made for the car out of lumber and clothesline to the time where I was going to take the canoe out in the morning for a quick fishing trip and managed to tip over launching the thing and ended up to my neck in water while the rest of the guys were sleeping. So I ended up trying to keep it quiet to where I didn't tip it off that I had tipped it over. And as a result, I got out of the water, put the canoe up, and changed into my dry clothes before anybody got up, and nobody ever knew the difference until I told it in the book. So
should have kept it secret, Jim.
Yep, that's a fact. But there's just so many opportunities in the woods when something goes wrong to laugh at yourself, but also to laugh at others. And that's the important thing out of the book was you got to be able to take it as well as give it, or else, you know, you'll never make it in a camping environment at any level.
Given how beneficial these trips were and how memorable they were, what then precipitated the end of this tradition?
It actually came about in 1991. I had just married. I think I did one more trip after I was married. Everybody was kind of done with being together for 5 years, and we were all starting our own families and relationships to the point where the wives started having say, and vacation time became a premium, and it kind of just ran its course like many things in life. It was a new chapter, and we just kind of agreed that maybe we'll pick it up again someday, but maybe not. And so it was unfortunate, but I guess we got a lot out of the time we were up there, so it wasn't for naught.
Now, the book is dedicated to your brother, Rob, and in a very moving part of the book, you talk about the last fishing trip you take with Rob. Tell mm-hmm. us about that.
It's hard to put into words without getting all broken up, but it really, he had what was called a celebration of life party because we knew his condition was terminal. He had cancer, a spinal cancer that they operated on, removed the tumors. A few months later, the tumors came back, and they deemed it spread to his lungs, and it became terminal. So at his celebration of life party, which was a party of about 200 of his closest friends and family, an event that he wanted to do to say goodbye, the question was raised was maybe we could get the brothers out one more time fishing and accommodate him. He was in a wheelchair at the time, and just kind of get the band back together. So we took it upon ourselves to rent a pontoon on White Bear Lake. It's an urban lake right in the Twin Cities, and we had just an awesome, awesome experience with taking him out. He caught the most fish. He caught the first fish. He caught the biggest fish, as it should be. The rest of us were all kind of in the background just catching one here or there, and he just stole the show, and it was just one of those aha moments where you're like, this is what it's all about. So glad I had to do it. It was just such an opportunity to just one more time do it like we had done it.
What precipitated the decision to start up the tradition again, to resurrect it?
Well, I think part of it with us and this generation that we're raising is they are a bit disconnected from the natural environment. And my brother, as he's head of the DNR, and he's very big into getting kids outdoors again, getting them away from their screens, getting them into the woods and into on the water and fishing and hunting and everything like that. And that's part of our thing is we wanted to pass that love on because it is such a great opportunity to bond with your children, to experience nature, to get in touch with, you know, your inner self, with others. It's just it's almost a mystical kind of experience, and we wanted to share that with our kids.
Why was it important for you to go back there, even after the passing of your brother, to make sure that this tradition carried on in a new way?
Part of it was to show that we will persevere, that despite all of this adversity we've had in our lives, and we've had a fair amount. My sister died at the age of 5 of a Wilms tumor. My dad died at a young age, and my brother now. And so we just wanted to prove to ourselves that adversity can set us back, but it will not deter us from continuing to try and make a conscious effort to get together as a family and to do the things that Rob would have loved to do with us. And so it was important that we include his daughter on this last trip again. And we pulled in my nephew, whose father died at a young age, too. And so it was funny. I mentioned in the book that they, at one point, the two of them were in what we called the orphan canoe because neither of them had fathers. And they laughed at it. But it was a moving trip in that it was the first one without Rob. So he was on our minds all the time, all of us. And it actually turned out to be just a really great experience, despite the bugs and the rain and whatever that we get every trip.
What do you hope other families will take from the memories your families have made in this beautiful wilderness area?
Well, it's my hope that anybody who is on the fence about going up to the Boundary Waters would realize that as you get older, especially in closer to retirement, it's just going to be more difficult to do it. So do it now. Do it when your kids are young. They tend to, as they get older, get stuck in their ways. If you instill this love in nature in them early, they'll be more inclined to go up in their 20s and 30s when it's really important to see how this area differs than, say, camping at a state park where you're in a car and you can always drive back home if you want. Up there, all you have is each other. All you have is what you pack. So it's about the minimalistic lifestyle that everybody should experience once in a while just to realize how good they do have it.
Well, Jim Landwehr, thank you so much for sharing this memoir with us.
Thank you, Stephanie. I appreciate the opportunity to do that.
Jim Landwehr's new book is called Dirty Shirt, a Boundary Waters memoir. Landwehr, who lives in Waukesha and is a member of the All Writers Workplace and Workshop, will talk about his book Friday evening at 6 at Martha Merrill's Bookshop in Waukesha. Lake Effect essayist Carrie Taylor Carlson can also recall some transformative canoeing. It wasn't in the Boundary Waters, but in the Intermountain West.
20 years ago, I paddled down the Green River in Utah for the first time, solo. The Green meanders through Labyrinth Canyon, where red rock walls tower 1,500 feet on both sides, turning it into a wilderness Wall Street minus the traffic jams. On this November journey, I experienced sunny days, chilly but not cold nights, the thrill of adventure, and the panic of the unknown around every bend. I paddled as hard as I could, as though trying to outrun the terror that lodged in my stomach and sat there for 5 days. Was it a spectacular trip? I wouldn't know. I barely glanced at the colorful rocks. Only my body was present. In my head, my monkey brain ran a non-stop dialogue that went something like, I'm terrified. I'll never get out of here alive. Why am I here? I'm normally a joyous person, but I found nothing to smile about on this trip. Obsessed, overwhelmed by fear, I paddled so desperately that I finished a day early. Not my style. I like to float, kick my feet in the water, drift. When it was over, I couldn't tell anyone what happened. I just wanted it to end. I wished I'd been there, relaxed, gazing at the scenery and savoring each minute. Last year, a friend and I decided to canoe to the confluence of the Green and the Colorado River. We would float, kick our feet in the water, drift, and lift our paddles only when absolutely necessary. We envisioned a leisurely trip down the Green, filled with laughter as we leaned back in our canoe seats and let the river take us to 8 perfect campsites. In mid-October, we anticipated sunny days, no bugs, no wind, and a lazy river. But Moab had an October heat wave, and as we set out on a 95-degree day, James, our outfitter, said, "Did you bring anything for the mosquitoes?" Note, there are no mosquitoes on the Green in October. That was until last year, when summer floods left breeding ponds that exploded with new hatches on the exact day we set out on our journey. I whined and moaned about the excessive heat while Denise slapped at mosquitoes that smothered her face and head, as they preferred her blood to mine. They crawled under her river hat and invaded her neck underneath her bandana. Huddled in her tent, she cursed the stupid bugs while I tried to cool down on the river. When I emerged, covered with mud, Denise took pictures. At the end of day three, a gust of wind picked up our tents with the sleeping bags in them and deposited them nearby in a slimy green pond. "I think there's a storm coming," Denise said, as she dragged her tent out of the mud bath. By the time we finished dinner, the sky had turned from blue to black, the temperature had plummeted from 90 to 50, and sheets of rain pelted our cozy camp. The storm had arrived. Betrayed by the formerly benign river that had treated me well on several previous trips, we struggled. Heat and bugs forgotten, we had new demons to slay. We were crazed women, trying to stay upright on a river that wouldn't relax. The wind blew us backwards, spun our canoe in waves that splashed over the bow, and tried to dump us as we scanned the banks for shelter from the storm that wouldn't quit. We paddled to exhaustion, then hauled the canoe up steep banks and prayed it would be safe from the wind. At the end of each day, we put rocks inside our tents so they would still be there after dinner. We were cold, tired, cranky, scared, exhilarated. This was not the idyllic journey we envisioned back in Milwaukee. It was better. I had no time for my former, "Why am I here?" or my, "I'm terrified," monkey brain chatter. We were busy with the business of staying alive. Despite our tears, and yes, we did occasionally tear up from fright or relief, we laughed at our misfortunes. What else could we do? We laughed when we sat in the mud to eat lunch and howled at the wind when we lost control of the canoe in the foaming river. We hooted at the rain and cheered when we could look up at the scenery. We laughed at ourselves when we grunted like weightlifters. Most of the time, we laughed at our plan, how we thought we would float, kick our feet in the water, drift. On the day before we finished, intuition may have saved our lives. It was late afternoon, and we had 10 miles to the confluence. "Should we keep going or bag it?" Denise took her paddle out of the river and looked back at me. "It's not that far. We can do 10 miles. Come on, let's get it over with." Then Denise said, "I think we should quit. I have a bad feeling about this." About the same time we finished setting up our tents, another storm slammed us as we sat relaxed, sipping wine. 2-foot waves grew from riffles, while sheets of cold rain pounded our camp. We would have been trapped by those towering walls with no safe place to get off the river for the next 10 miles. If hypothermia didn't kill us, then death by drowning would have done us in. Back in Moab, we didn't look so bad, with our hat hair and mud-caked clothes. And hidden underneath our river hats, we wore the proud, giddy smiles of survivors.
Lake Effect essayist Carrie Carlson is a freelance writer, outdoor guide in the West and overseas, and former environmental educator. She lives in Milwaukee, and her essay first aired in 2012. That's all for Wednesday's edition of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. It's so great to have you listening today and every day at this time. You can tune in once again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 and weekend afternoons at 3 for more of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. We're your NPR station in Milwaukee. Coming up at noon today from WBUR and NPR in Boston, it's Here or Now. But right now, it's 11 o'clock, and stay tuned because Fresh Air is next.